Breeding animals in captivity is a challenge faced by zoos all over the world. At Nepal's only zoo in Kathmandu, they've tried to build the perfect mating environment for their two Asian one-horned rhinos, an enclosure they call the honeymoon suite. Our correspondent Joanna Jolly went along to see how its occupants were settling in.
Kancha is a 20-year-old one-horned rhino. He's wallowing in a pool of muddy water with his female companion, 22-year-old Kanchi. Although the pair have been in captivity together for 18 years, this display of closeness was a rare sight in the past. The cramped enclosure meant they often fought and had to be separated. This is why conservationists have built what they're calling a rhino honeymoon suite, complete with a large shared area as well as separate living quarters. The project's been funded by ACE Development Bank of Nepal. Its CEO, Siddhant Pandey, says the enclosure already seems to be encouraging a better relationship.
In the past, they used to keep them apart because they used to fight a lot. But recently, maybe because of the environment, maybe of this, because of this habitat center, you see them socializing.
The aim is to encourage the rhinos to breed in captivity, something they haven't done in Nepal in the past. Asian one-horned rhinos are an endangered species. There are only 435 left in the wild in Nepal. They're under threat from poaching, as well as habitat loss, due to an expansion of farmland and the growth of an invasive plant species that's destroyed the natural ecosystem. Kathmandu Zoo manager Sarita Janwali says the rhino population in Nepal also suffered during its 10-year civil conflict, which ended in 2006.
In National Park, army is guarding the wildlife together with the National Park staff. But during insurgency period, the army people, their priority were shift to the other things, you see. They have other priorities, and most of these park guarding posts were destroyed by the insurgent. So animals were badly disturbed.
A rhino pregnancy can last up to 18 months, and the zoo is keeping a close eye on the female rhino, Kanchi, to see if she's expecting. They hope that this captivity breeding program will mean they'll eventually be able to release one-horned rhinos back into the wild.
Joanna Jolly in Kathmandu on the honeymoon suite at Nepal Zoo. I'm Helen Fawkes, and now a reminder of today's main world news from the BBC. And the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has urged foreign donors to increase aid to Pakistan. He said he'd never seen a disaster on such a scale. Japan's economic growth has slowed sharply, raising fears of a double-dip recession in the world's second-largest economy. The American military commander in Afghanistan says there could be changes to the plan to start withdrawing troops next year. It's coming up to 1:41 GMT.
Hello, I'm Steve Evans. Welcome to Business Daily, in which does Nanny know best? Let's tax sweet fizzy drinks.
The calories in, that is what people are eating, is much more important than the calories out, how much people are exercising. So the food industry simply can't get off the hook by trying to point the finger to physical activity.
And keeping it all in the family.
Yeah, I guess the problem with nepotism is that it's got a negative connotation. You know, I prefer to say it's family secession.
All in Business Daily from the BBC. It seems such an obvious idea. We do something which makes us fat and rots our teeth, so why shouldn't the government help us kick the habit? Or, what business does the nanny state have in deciding our tastes? We're grown-ups, and we have the right to choose unhealthy pleasure, do we not? Those are the two conflicting arguments which are playing out in a string of American states from New York to Washington on the Pacific. The argument is that taxing sodas, fizzy, sweetened drinks, would prompt healthier living and raise money for good things like schools in the process. In New York City, Mayor Bloomberg reckons that another 12 cents on a can would raise nearly $1 billion. In Philadelphia, Deputy Mayor Donald Schwartz emphasized how much a family could lose in a good way, like the number of calories imbibed.
For a family of three, that family on average, while it may sound horrifying to your audience, drinks a 2-liter bottle of soda for dinner. It's about a cup of sugar divided over three members of a family. If they changed that consumption to water for two dinners a week, the family would collectively lose about 24 pounds in a year. We consider that substantial.
Now, clearly the fizzy drinks industry is not convinced. It argues that the calories from a can of its product is a very small proportion of the daily intake, and also that just cutting down on sugar in drinks might not actually work. Here's Garrett Quigley, the chief executive of Pepsi UK.
We want to help consumers make healthier choices, and sugar reduction is part of that. With soft drinks, it's all about taste, and if you take too much sugar out at one point in time, the consumer really notices, and they'll simply switch out of our brand into another brand, and that really means we won't have achieved anything. So if we can gradually take our consumers with us, that's a much better way to do it. If we change the taste drastically, the consumer won't buy our products, and if the research tells us they won't, then we won't go that far.
So let's thrash this thing out. Kelly Brownell is the director of the Rudd Centre for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale. But first, Samro, who speaks for the industry under the umbrella of the Union of European Beverages Associations. She argues that connections between health and the amount we eat aren't simple.
This is an issue of basically calories in, calories out, as I understand it. And certainly here in Europe, and obviously I speak for Europe, calorie intake has remained stable over the past 30 years. What has changed, of course, is our lifestyles, in that we take the bus or take the car rather than cycle and walk. We have much more sedentary jobs, much more sedentary lifestyles, get the Hoover out, get the washing machine out, and that people's exercise has gone down.
With all due respect to Sam, I don't agree with her interpretation of the available science. Calorie intake has gone up around the world. The food industry in the United States basically makes the same claim, that calorie intake hasn't gone up, but it has. That's a self-serving interpretation of the available science. So that needs to be challenged. Recent science shows that the calories in, that is what people are eating, is much more important than the calories out, how much people are exercising, for determining levels of obesity in the society. So the food industry simply can't get off the hook by trying to point the finger to physical activity. And by the way, children are exposed to enormous number of advertisements through what they see on the media in general, billboards that they see, machines that dispense the beverages and the like. And so children at very young ages, even though the companies claim they're not being marketed to, develop brand loyalty for the major brands. So I really don't believe that that claim is true.
Samro, it is hard to see how you keep kids under 12 in some kind of vacuum where you keep them away from the Coke machine, the Pepsi machine or whatever.
Well, certainly kids under 12, in Europe, are required to be under the supervision of their parents or carers. We don't have any machines in schools, in primary schools. That was what we understood parents wanted, that they wanted to have control. So certainly a child going to school with its lunchbox will not be able to purchase one of our beverages. And certainly in the supermarket with its parent, presumably it's under parental control.
Dr. Brownell, I come back to this point. When do you say that it's for an individual to decide what's good and bad? You get the information out, certainly, but it's for ordinary people to know their own best interest.
That assumption holds if people have good information about nutrition. So, first
well,
of all...
Get better information out, then. Just tell them.
No, that's fine. The government can do that, except its budget to do so is pitifully small compared to what the food industry is spending to convince people to eat unhealthy foods. You add to that deceptive and misleading packaging practices, especially in the U.S., where companies are allowed to make health claims left and right on their products. It's very hard for consumers to know how good a certain product truly is.
But can there be anybody who really thinks that a can of fizzy sugared drink is good for them? We all know it.
Oh, of course. You put vitamins in it, it becomes vitamin water. You put other things in it, you call it antioxidant beverage. There are so many of these beverages that are basically just sugar added to water and coloring, but a few things are thrown in gratuitously where people are told it's good for them. Look at the marketing of sports drinks, for example. Gatorade and Powerade and have very high sales in the U.S. because people believe that they need to do them if they do the least bit of exercise. The marketing has created tremendous demand for these beverages. That's why the consumption is so high. People essentially know that drinking sugar water is not good for them, but they're told that these products have magic qualities when they really don't, and when people are misled, something really needs to be done.
And that seems to be true, Sam Rowe, doesn't it? You look at the way some sugary drinks are marketed now, you'd think they're an aid to athleticism.
Well, certainly sports drinks have a
role.
What
is a sports drink?
A sports drink is a drink that gives you added liquid after sports. You need to rehydrate your body
with... Like a glass of water?
Well, you actually lose a number of nutrients as well when you exercise, and so it replaces those nutrients quickly.
And it gives you energy, is the way it's marketed, and I translate that as calories, because that's what it is.
Sure. Well, I mean, sugar is energy. If you want a no energy, no sugar product, then you choose a no sugar or a low sugar product.
So what do you reckon, Sam Rowe, the effect would be if the tax was slapped on at a higher level?
Well, of course, taxing soft drinks would tax one element of people's food and drink intake. It wouldn't address everything else that they eat or drink. Also, tax, of course, it would be a regressive tax. Raising taxes on food and drink places a disproportionate burden on the less well-off members of society, obviously because food and drink is a greater percentage of their monthly outgoings.
No class element, finally, Dr. Brownell. You know, you pick on Gatorade, but that's what working-class people who go to NASCAR meetings drink. You don't pick on, I don't know, foie gras or marbled beef or whatever that rich people consume. Why just pick on poor people's beverages?
Another legitimate question, but the response here is that diseases like obesity are regressive diseases, and they most disproportionately hurt the poor. Second is that the beverage companies have spent many years specifically cultivating people in some of those categories because of the low education as customers, and that needs to be corrected.
Difficulty is, truly finally, I don't want to drink carrot juice. I quite like sugar beverages.
Well, you might quite like cigarettes, too, and you can go ahead and consume those. Nobody's prohibiting you from doing that, but you'll have to pay more to help compensate your country for the health care costs incurred by consumption of that product.
Ooh, touche. Justly chided by Kelly Brownell there. He's the director of the Rudd Centre for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale. And before that, Sam Rowe from the Union of European Beverages Associations. What's the role of nanny? world.business@bbc.co.uk.